Okay.
I'm ready.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Next hour and a quarter.
Okay, we're all ready. Let's have a sem. And we are looking at a ma'amar, Kabbalistic Hasidic discourse, which was said just before Erev Chag HaSukkot in 1975. Tavshin Lamed Vav is 1975. And on the 13th of Tishrei, which is also the yahrzeit of the 4th Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Shmuel, the Admur Maharash. Now, Reb Shmuel is very interesting because he wrote, he was the first person really to write what is called Hemshechim, a Hemshech. That means that on Shabbat number one, he gives he delivers a discourse, and there's a beginning and a middle and an end. The beginning and the end relate to the Parshat HaShavua. Then the next week, he gives another Maima with the beginning, which relates to the Parshat HaShavua, and the end, like asking a question, which is finally solved at the end. But the middle relates to the middle from the week before. So over 30 weeks, he could express a whole extended discourse, which is really a one unified idea, which is being explored and explained on different levels and different dimensions, which is all the middles of the discourses. And that's called a hemshech, a continuation, a continued line of discourses. So he invented that concept in Chabad. Rab Shmuel, he lived, he died around 1882. He passed away in the town of Lubavitch in Belarus. And after him, his son Rab Sholem Dov Be'er was famous for long hemsheichim as well. His son followed suit, as it were, and created some of the most fascinating teachings in the history of Jewish thought. And Rav Shmuel's also are very beautiful. But he launched this concept. So a lot of this discourse relates to a hemshech, a series of discourses which begins v'kacha. Now v'kacha is from a pasuk, V'kacha tochlu oto. Thus should you eat it. What's that talking about? Anyone?
Korban Pesach.
Korban Pesach. That's right. Or the actual. No, thank you. The Paschal lamb when they were leaving Egypt. V'kacha tochlu oto. This is how you should eat it. Girded with ready to leave Egypt. And the Hemshech, the series of discourses that begins with Kacha, extended for months and months and included an explanation of all the Chagim. All the Chagim, like, fit into that, that Hemshech. So that series of discourses. Now, so this discourse was said on his Yahrzeit, which is the, 13th of Tishrei in 1978. Five.
The Maharash is the one that wrote the beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah, that's right. Hemshechim. He began that style. His son, Reb Shalom Dov Be'er, and for that matter, his grandson, Reb Yosef Yitzchak, continued that style.
And who did this Maimer?
However, the actual Maimer is by Reb Menachem Mendel, by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who passed away in 1994. Mm-hmm. So, and he said it in 1975. Tavshin Lamed Vav, which is 1975. Now, it goes on the verse at the beginning of, if you look on the first page, it's speaking about Sukkot. At the bottom of the first page, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lemor, Hashem said to Moshe, saying, Dabel b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, Lemos saying b'chamisha asa yom lachodesh hashvi'i azeh, on the 15th day of this 7th month is Chag HaSukkot, the festival of Sukkot. And we go over the page. Shivat Yamim LaHashem, 7 days for Hashem. And then it speaks about how on the first day is a sacred day where one doesn't do any work. And then for 7 days an offering is brought. It's a rather complicated offering. This is from Sefer Vayikra, from Parshat Emor. It doesn't go into the details of the offering, but the details are in Parshat Pinchas, in Sefer Bamidbar, where it gives a list of what is actually offered. We may come to discuss more in detail about that. And then it goes down the page, let's look at verse 40. Ulekachtem lachem b'yom harishon. You should take for yourself on the first day pri etz hadar, kapot marim, va'anaf etz avot va'arve nachal. This is referring to the pri etz hadar is the etrog, kapot marim is the lulav, anaf etz avot is the myrtle, and arve nachal, the willow of the brook. Usmachtem lifnei Hashem Elokechem shivat yamim, and you should rejoice before Hashem your God for 7 days. V'chagoto oto chag l'Hashem, you should celebrate it as a chag, a festival for God. Shivat yamim b'shana, 7 days in a year. And then it goes on, verse 42. Basukot teshvu shivat yamim. In Sukkot, in booths, you should dwell for 7 days. Kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael, every citizen in Israel, each word here is pregnant with meaning. Kol ezrach, the word ezrach is, I mean, it's a very common word today, ezrach, you know, to liot ezrach, a citizen, ezrachi, ezrachut, but the word ezrach, what does ezrach literally mean?
It is shining.
Yes, it's the word zarach and ezrach, you know, like in the future, you know. It's got a mystical undertones.
How does ezrach shining comes to ezrach citizen?
Well, I'm actually not sure why the word ezrach means citizen. I mean, it does mean citizen in biblical Hebrew. It's not a modern word that Ben Yehuda made up. It is a word from the Tanakh.
Yeah, but what do you think was ezrach here?
Here it means citizen.
They didn't have to put zeut there.
Well, there is a whole question all the way through the Chumash about the identity of the Jew. And you have the idea of the B'nai Yisrael, then you have the Gerim.
The Gerim are
Ezrachim. Kol HaEzrach V'Hager. You see, there are different levels of, there are different terminologies concerning members of the Jewish people. The idea of being part of Am Yisrael is given very great significance in the Torah, in the Chumashei Torah. And so definitions of membership or terminology regarding membership are also part of that. There's the sages elaborate it more, but you can see within the text of the Torah itself very a great concern about who actually is part of this people. And right from the beginning, you have the idea of Avraham wanting that his son should marry someone from his own family and not from the Canaanites. So there's all the time a tension of the Jewish people in relation to the nations of the world. And it's almost as if this tension is part of the built-in tension in relation to existence. There are tensions in terms of the creation of the world, the spiritual and the physical. It's not like a smooth process, the idea of creating a world and then there's a world and that's the end of the matter. It's like a coiled spring which is waiting to to become uncoiled or something to go wrong. You know, and sure enough, things do go wrong. That's they go wrong all the time. That's because of these, which the Kabbalah presents in different ways. There is the tension of orot, radiance, and kelim, and vessel. So that could be harmonious, that the radiance dwells within the vessel in a harmonious way, or it can be cataclysmic, as we have with the concept of shvirat ha-kelim, the breaking of the vessels, as a result of the orot, the radiance is so intense that the vessels shatter. So all this, it's really the infinite and the finite. So in terms of existence, we're talking about a delicate balance of the infinite and the finite. And we are all the time, mitmodedim, we're trying to balance this situation of, on the one hand, something infinite, and on the other, something finite. That's like my image of, probably shared with you at some time, the age of 17 or something, going to Istanbul and the bridge over the Bosphorus, and which joins Europe and Asia. So there's a bridge which joins Europe and Asia, and the bridge has got like a gaps in the bridge, so that if it gets very hot, then the metal will expand, so it expands into the gap, so it doesn't buckle. So if you stand with one foot this side and one foot the other side, one foot's in Europe, the other's in Asia. Yes? So it occurred to me that that is really the image of the situation of a person in life today. Exactly that. Trying to balance, if Europe represents one side or the other represents the spiritual and the other represents the physical. But we are trying to balance that. And the whole of culture is really an expression of that tension, of that grappling with these powerful forces which we try to mediate in our lives. So there we have the idea of dwelling in Sukkot, and Kol HaEzrach Yisrael, verse 42-43, every citizen of Israel, of the Jewish people, should yeshvu basukot, should dwell in Sukkot, lema'an yed'u dorotechem, in order that your generations should know, ki vasukot hoshavti et b'nei Yisrael, that I made the Jewish people, that means the children of Israel, dwell in Sukkot. I made them dwell in Sukkot, when I took them out of the land of Egypt, I am Hashem your God. And then it says that Moshe spoke, told over these festivals of God to the Jewish people. And so that's the theme text which begins the discourse. So if we turn over the page, we have the discourse. Page Kuf Kav Vav. Now, a discourse is really, a Kabbalistic Hasidic discourse is really reaching into another realm of experience and consciousness. And so, when the Rebbe would say a discourse, very often there would be a melody which came before the discourse, in order, in some sense, to help people open to spiritually to hear the discourse. So we're going to sing that melody. Oh, ya, ba, ya, 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 yo, ya, yo. Ho, ya, 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 yo, ba, yo. Oh, ya, ba, ya, 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 yo, ya, yo. Ha ye yam ba ya yam ba yom, ah ho ya ye re ram ba ya ya ho ya ye re ram ba yam ba yom, Ha yere ramba, ha yere ramba, yo yamba ya ya yere ramba, ha ya yamba yere ramba, ho yamba yo yamba yo, aho ya 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 yere ramba ya 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 yo yere ramba ya, ha yere ramba ya yere da yo. Aha, ha, ya, 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 ramba, ya, ya, ba, ya, ya, ramba, ya, ha, ya, ra, ya, ra, ya, ra, ramba, ha, ya, ya, ramba, ya, ba, ya, 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 ramba, ya, ba, ya, ha, ya, ramba, ha, ya, ba, ho, Yamba ya yeramba, yamba yamba yeramba, oh yamba yo yamba yo. But Sukkot teshvu shivat yamin. In Sukkot you should dwell for 7 days. Umosif od tzibui, and then it adds another command. Kol ha'izrach b'Yisrael yeshvu b'Sukkot. Every Jewish citizen should dwell in Sukkot. But atam al zeh, the reason for this, leman yedu dorotechem, in order that your generation should know, ki basukot hoshavti et bnei Yisrael, that I made the Jewish people dwell in Sukkot, bo itzi otam me'eretz Mitzrayim, when I took them out of the land of Egypt. Okay, so that's the verses that we just read, a couple of the verses with a slight bit of explanation. And it's known the points that have been raised in the previous discourses by previous Rebbeim of the Chabad line coming from Rabbi Shneur Zalman down through to the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the one that he particularly focuses on, Ubahakdim, and particularly considering Masha Katav Bal Ha'ilula, what the person whose yotzeit it is today wrote, and you look in note 2, it says V'kacha. You see, it's referring to this hemshech of discourses, which is from Tafresh Lamed Zayin. That's a date. Can anyone tell me what date Tafresh Lamed Zayin is?
76, and it's the end. And Reish is Abamot.
Well, Reish is 200, okay. And Taf is 400. So that's 600. So you have to, the 5,000, you have to consider, yeah, as already that. So it's 5,677, right? So, yeah, and 37, which is 1877. That's when this stream of discourses was said, in 1877. And look at this, Perik Tzadik Vav, chapter 96. This is the 96th chapter of this long Hemshech, which began at Pesach time, and then by the time he got to Sukkot, he was talking about Sukkot, so it's all the way from Pesach to Sukkot, so it's 96 chapters of this hemshech of discourses, this stream of discourses. For many years, perhaps even still today, it was only available in a handwritten form, which has been printed from the handwriting. So it's like a book, a bound book, but when you open the book, it's handwritten. And it's an interesting feature of Chabad, these manuscript books which are printed. I once gave a lecture in Bar Ilan University about the manuscript in Chabad and the idea of these actually printing manuscript books, because the manuscript was written so clearly around 1910, 1915. By someone called Reb Shmuel the Sofer, speaking of the Sofer. So he was famous as a person, pages and pages, without a single mistake, without a single crossing out. He wrote so clearly that he would write, and they would use a method of reproduction called the hectograph. This is around 1910, 1920, where he writes on a piece of some kind of paper. The paper's put on a jelly, a flat jelly. Then it's peeled off. And then you can put another page on the jelly and peel it off, and it's got the writing on it. And you could make like 20 copies from one thing that's written. So he wrote so clearly that when in the 1950s, 1960s, they wanted to print these books, they didn't need to typeset the books. It was very clearly written, but handwritten, and they printed them in handwritten. Of course, it's more difficult to read in the handwriting, but it was a way of publishing the books quickly. In the immediate post-war period, when there was a big burst of publishing of Hasidic texts. So I should have brought one along.
But did you say this is the 96th chapter?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? There were 95 maimarim given before?
No, the chapters. With it, each maimar might have 6-7 chapters.
So there could be like 15, 16 maimarim.
Yeah, I mean from Pesach to Sukkot is several months. Oh. Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, and then finally Tishri. So it's 7 months later. So if there were two discourses a month, you know, that's already 14. And if there were more, if there were three discourses a month. So,
but they were all linked.
Yeah, they're all linked. Yeah. They were all linked. Yeah, a very fascinating concept.
Yeah.
And they're unfolding a whole story, and the story is the story of the way in which the festivals are connecting the Jewish people with God, and the way in which every detail of the festivals, in some way, in terms of the divine radiance which flows in the world, and the whole interface between existence. Physical existence, spiritual radiance, different levels of spiritual radiance. The Jew as an individual in the middle of all that, doing whatever he or she is supposed to be doing. And then you have the nations of the world, like other players on the scene. It's a drama. It's the drama of existence. Yeah. As explained, with a kind of a Lurianic Kabbalistic focus, but with a Hasidic knack. With a Hasidic look on it. Okay. So what is the Maharash, that's Reb Shmuel, what does he write there about the nature of Sukkah? I mean, he wrote many things, but there's one point being picked out here. Shesukkah hu inyan ha-shalom. The concept of Sukkah represents peace. Kamosha Katuv, as it's written, Ufros Aleinu Sukkat Shlomecha, spread over us the Sukkah of your peace. And that is actually part of the liturgy. It's the Ma'ariv prayer, which is said, the evening prayer, which is said on a festival or Shabbat. Spread out on us the Sukkah of your peace. But Tzarech Lahavin, we have to understand, Mahi Ashaychut the Sukkah L'Shalom. What's the connection between Sukkah and peace? Okay, so we've got one level of connection. Sukkah and peace. What does that mean? V'hine, b'shivat yimei ha-sukkot, in the 7 days of Sukkot, yeshnam kama inyanim. There are several different concepts. Hashayachim le-basukkot teshvu shivat yamim, relating to the idea of dwelling in the Sukkah for 7 days. Okomo, for example, such as mitzvah netilat arba minim, the mitzvah of taking the four kinds. As it says, ulekachtem lachem bayom harishon, you should take for yourself on the first day, which we read. Sheyesh la shaychut le'inyan ha-sukkah, which connects to the concept of the sukkah. Now, why does it connect to the sukkah? You might think of it as two completely different things. On the one hand, there's dwelling in the sukkah, making a sukkah, getting a kind of a hut, maybe making it out of two walls of the garden, and somehow fixing another wall, and then getting laurel leaves for schach and putting them on top. And then there's a completely different mitzvah, completely different thing of getting a lulav with, there's the palm branch and the myrtle and the arhavot, and then the citron, the, which is the etrog. So there we have, such as the wonderful one which has just been acquired.
I'll give you
Davis,
actually.
There we are.
Wouldn't dare use the keepers.
Yeah, there we are. It's a beautiful etrog. It's very lovely. So there we have the arba minim. That's one thing, and the other is the sukkah. Is there any way they relate together? What does it mean they relate together? But uchyadua, as is known, shemitzvah min amucha. The best way of fulfilling the mitzvah is shenetilat arba minim tiyeh b'sukkah. Is that the taking, the waving of these four kinds should be in the sukkah itself. That's the best way of doing it. As it says in the Siddur written by Rabbi Shneur Zalman, and it says, look at note 5, Ure'ei Mishnat Chassidim Memchet. Memchet is Mishnat Chassidim, that is a Kabbalistic book written in the 17th century by someone called Rabbi Emanuel Hayriki, very interesting man, a man who could write music, he could write music, musical notation. He wrote another book, which is a commentary on the Mishnah, and in that book there is a piece of music written as well, which he, and he wrote poems. He's an Italian Kabbalist. You know, each kind of Kabbalist is, depends where they come from. So he's an Italian Kabbalist with the style of Italy. So he writes there that the best thing is to shake the lulav and etrog in the sukkah. So therefore, that's the way we're looking at it. And so that's one of the themes of Sukkot. If we just stop at this point for a second, you see, you have the idea of a radiance which is flowing. There is the infinite above Ein Sof, and there is a flow of radiance. Now, this flow of radiance is really what is called Orot Makifim, a radiance which flows around. And what is happening is that we are trying to, if we imagine ourselves inside the sukkah, that this is somehow, this is the sukkah, and that there is a person there who is shaking the lulav and etrog, right? So there is a person with their lulav and etrog, and the shaking of the lulav and etrog is somehow drawing the radiance down from this, what is really orot makifin, but it's that means surrounding radiance, but it's drawing down so that it flows. It's almost like an aerial, you know, like that. It's drawing down this radiance, so the radiance comes down into the world. That's the image. So therefore, the concept of being in the sukkah, it's as if one has stepped into a realm which is focusing this surrounding radiance, or the sukkah itself expresses the surrounding radiance. But then we're drawing that radiance down into bipnimiyut. Now, it sometimes seems to me, you know, in wave motion, one can talk of waves and particles. You know, it's as if they're different waves of describing energy. So, in spiritual terms as well, there is the kind of spiritual energy which is makifin, a surrounding radiance, and the kind of energy which is bipnimiyut, which comes inwardly. And so what is happening with the sukkah, and what is the most mysterious thing, what the discourse sees as a very surprising thing to be able to achieve, is that there should be hityashvut, dwelling in a surrounding radiance. The surrounding radiance itself has got a chaotic dimension to it. It is beyond the scale of existence where everything fits in place and it's got a special place to be. The surrounding radiance is beyond borders. There are no borders for the surrounding radiance. The inward radiance is something which is measured. The inward radiance has to fit in. In some way, it has to fit in. I mean, one of the ways of depicting the inward radiance is the way in which a person understands something. Now, if you're told an idea, then either you understand it or you don't understand it. It's something that has to go into the mind and fit into the mind. If there is something irrational about the idea and you can't grasp it in your mind, or you haven't understood it in such a way that you can grasp it, so it doesn't quite fit in the mind. It's not there. Whereas if the idea is with the right kind of illustrations and proofs and explanations, it'll fit into the mind. So it fits into the mind. Makif, surrounding, is something quite different. Like a person desires something. They want something. The will is described as a koach, a power of makif within the person. It's a surrounding force. You don't necessarily have an explanation why you want something. You want a certain thing. You want to climb a certain mountain. Now, why do you want to climb that mountain? What got into you that you want to climb that mountain? There are people who devote their lives and risk their lives and sometimes unfortunately lose their life because they have a tremendous passion to climb the north face of the Eiger. You know, so what is it? You know, what's the explanation? There's no explanation. That's what they want. There's a tremendous desire. So a will, ratzon, is something surrounding. It doesn't have kelim. It doesn't have vessels in which it fits. Whereas an intellectual concept where you can explain that A plus B equals C and D plus E equals F and therefore, and you give a whole explanation in which it all fits together, that's a structure which can go into the mind. So that's the difference between the inner radiance, which becomes part of the person, part of the world, part of daily reality. Hityashvut, dwelling, that's the inner radiance. Makifin, surrounding, is a chaotic form of radiance which doesn't actually fit into something. If we go back to the basic Kabbalistic image of radiance going into vessels like the Sfirot, kindness, severity, mercy, and so on. So you have the different Sfirot, and within each Sfira there is a radiance. So the radiance has gone into the vessel. That's Orot Pnimiyim. That's the inner radiance. But at the same time, there is Orot Makifim, there is surrounding radiance. And the surrounding radiance has many different qualities, and to a certain extent, that can be, it's too powerful. It's too powerful to enter into vessels. So one of the points of wonder that is expressed in this discourse, how can we imagine that basukot, which represent a surrounding radiance, that we're able to dwell in a sukkah? It's like two opposites.
Why sukkot represents surrounding radiance?
Why? The reason why sukkot represents surrounding radiance is because in the Talmud there is a discussion what the sukkah represents. Right? There's a command in the Torah to dwell in sukkot, and so the sages discuss, I believe it's Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, but I might be wrong, they are discussing what is the symbolism of the sukkah. One says it is the booth that the people dwelt in on their way out of Egypt, dwelling in the desert. They made themselves booths, like little huts, and that's where they lived. So we make little huts in order to depict that. The other rabbi, maybe Rabbi Eliezer, he says, no, it's not the booths. This is in the Talmud, in Sukkah, in Tractate Sukkah. He says it's not the booth. It is the clouds of glory, Anenei HaKavod, which surrounded the Jewish people. While Am Yisrael were going through the desert, while the Jewish people are going through the desert, there was a mysterious cloud which surrounded them. And this cloud protected them from the sun, and whenever there was any hill, it somehow flattened the hill, and it would clean their clothes. It was an amazing thing, but it was something surrounding them. And our sukkah with the leaves represents these anane kavod, these clouds of glory. So that's the image of a surrounding, some kind of spiritual surrounding energy. So if you follow that, Rabbi Eliezer, so that helps explain why the sukkah is seen as a surrounding radiance. And the roof of the sukkah, yeah?
I'm not guessing what it means, the radiance coming in, the going out, surrounding, like, what does that, any of that even mean? I understand the concept of what you're saying about something that fits into a will, and then something that makes sense that you can fit in the mind, but what's that got, I don't know, what does it mean that the surrounding radiance and that comes into the second, and what's even, I don't know, it just doesn't, what is this radiance, what is it doing, why do we care what it's doing?
Well, it's an interesting thing that the way in which Kabbalistic and therefore, if you like, Hasidic teachings explain the paradoxes of life is in terms of spiritual radiance. And the idea that the infinite, that aspect of the infinite that we're able to imagine in any way, we can think of it as Or Ein Sof, the radiance of the infinite. So the first way in which to consider what there is before existence, let's imagine that there is no world, that there's nothing, that there's only the oneness of the infinite. So one way of thinking of that is that there is in fact no way to imagine it whatsoever. There's nothing to imagine. It's completely beyond our human experience in any way whatsoever. We only have words and ideas and images for things that in some way we have experienced. And so there is a way of a level at which one could depict the infinite that is beyond words. There's nothing to say in any way whatsoever, nothing to imagine, nothing to think. But then there is the concept of Or Ein Sof, the radiance of the infinite. Now, to imagine an infinite, boundless radiance, that's not so, that's not such a remote thing for a person to be able to imagine. There's nothing else, just infinite radiance, lost in radiance. There's no world, there's no sun, moon, or stars. It's just radiance, boundless radiance. And somehow, the mind has got the capacity to imagine something like that. Then you take it a step further. You say that this radiance becomes veiled in such a way. See, that's the crucial point in the Lurianic Kabbalah. That if you only have radiance, where does the world fit in? How will you ever have a world? If everything is infinite radiance, how does the world fit in? So there's the idea of a veiling of the radiance, called tzimtzum, a hiding of the radiance. And so therefore, in this pocket of hiding of the radiance, that's where the world, as we begin to understand it, is created. And it means that one is thinking in terms of flow of radiance. And that's a way of understanding existence. Now, is that in any way, does that relate to our ordinary physical way of understanding existence? The funny thing is that in our time, in the last 100 years, 150 years, study of existence shows us that in fact radiance is a perfectly, in terms of physical radiance, it's a perfectly reasonable way to describe what existence is. Because the concept that all physical matter is really a form of energy, and the matter can be translated into energy with a famous formula that of course everyone knows, Ellie.
Everyone knows.
Yeah, you see this famous formula. E equals m c squared. Now that comes from Einstein. E is energy, equals m is mass, c is the speed of light, squared. Now if you have energy, if you have a mass times a speed, the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second. So you've got a 1 gram, which is running along at 186,000 miles a second. That's an enormous force. And so that energy, that is a way of describing what is the energy of 1 gram. As a result of this whole equation and what comes out from it, you have the atom bomb. The idea that you can release the energy in a small amount of physical matter. So an atom bomb is simply an amount, the original early atom bomb was a certain amount of uranium, which is a metal which will easily translate from the physical mass into the energy. And if you have enough of it, which is not a huge amount, it will suddenly blow up, and instead of the few kilograms of metal, you suddenly have a huge amount of light and heat. So this idea that everything in existence can translate into light and heat means that we're sitting in a kind of a continuum where the energy is somehow restrained, and you have a stool and a chair and a tree and the sea and the mountain, but actually it's the idea that there is some powerful radiant energy dimension to existence just in physical terms. This is not talking about spiritual energy, it's talking about physical energy. But it's not so far-fetched. So for our generation, schooled in this kind of way and being able to see the world as an electromagnetic spectrum where everything around us, forget about the E equals MC squared, everything is made of atoms. And the atom is made of little charges of energy, neutron, proton, electron. So those are different charges which somehow hang together within the atom. That's what existence is. Where you touch your own hand, that's what it is. It's all these charges of electromagnetic energy. So the idea that in the Kabbalah there's a spiritual energy which is the source of all this, it's not so far. I find it interesting that while these ideas, these Kabbalistic ideas, are fairly easy, I would say, for modern man to think about, they actually originate more than a very long time ago, 1,000, 2,000 years ago, speaking in these terms, where we have written texts talking about this kind of way of looking at existence. So it's just interesting that Jewish teaching has this this sort of spiritual way of looking at existence, which today is not so far from just a very practical, objective way of seeing the world. Also, this reaches into, philosophical questions, because philosophically, really, all this is a metaphor. It's a metaphor. It's not in itself what the actual reality is. It's a way of speaking about the reality. But the fact that we can imagine these concepts or train ourselves to imagine those concepts, so that's the step that we is being asked of us, in a way, to be able to imagine it and to think about it in those terms. And when we do, then we are able to see relationships that we wouldn't perceive otherwise, and their relationships, which are significant for our own lives and for our sense of purpose and what the world is actually doing. Because the most mysterious quality is just being alive at all. And what is this physical world that we are surrounded by? You know, and what exactly is it? And these teachings of Kabbalah with Hasidic thought help us to mediate the world and find a vocabulary to speak about the different forces and, I would say, also the different paradoxes which are there, because there are deep paradoxes, and our ability to join those paradoxes, that's what makes us into a human being who is able in some way to contribute something to the world. Because if we can mediate our own paradoxes, we can help another person mediate their. So that's the peace, that's the concept of shalom, of peace in the sukkah, that there is a sense in which the sukkah is doing the impossible in some spiritual sense, that there is a radiance which in itself would not fit into anything. Now in life there are different radiances which don't fit into anything. Have you ever seen Edvard Munch's painting called The Scream? It is a picture of... you've seen it? Yes. It's a painting of a person in a schizophrenic state. I mean, that's the normal way of understanding it. Who is screaming, like a girl standing on a bridge. Screaming with a very, very intense scream, with psychedelic colors around her, which make you feel the intensity of that scream. Now, that is, in a sense, a person facing the unbearable intensity of existence, which they cannot, which she cannot bring inside. It's too big. The only way she can respond is with a scream. Now, it might be, you know, we could say, oh well, she's not well, she needs, you know, there's a sense in which it's not so much that she's not well, she's sensitive. And that sensitivity needs respect. The question is, how can a person take the intangible dimension of life, this infinite dimension, you know, that's what it is in a way, and then be able to package that within one's own being so that it becomes the inner radiance, bipnimiyut, which fits here and there and somewhere, you know, and just tucks in nicely. In a way, that's the challenge. It's as if there's this enormous energy around us, which can sometimes really threaten us in all kinds of ways, luring us into difficult situations. And our ability to make that into something which is tangible, the pnimiyot, and genuine. Oh, that's the picture. Thank you so much. Yes, it is. Yeah, although the colors are very psychedelic. Now you see the painter painted that, but there is a sense in which it's not just his painting. I mean, what makes a painting a famous painting is that many people see it as there, saying something for them as well. Thank you, Nicole.
If you give me a list before the lesson,
I was going to ask if when you say relating it to how human beings deal with
relating to something almost beyond themselves, in the sense that it's infinite and disconnected, perhaps, or working at a different level to the physical, then would most people not say that it's reason and rationality that is that mediating thing, that you describe, like, the difference between the will and intellect, so the will being the thing that perhaps is infinite and surrounding and not necessarily something you can kind of ground in you said reason, and then the thing that is coming in to the sukha being the thing that is more like intellect. So could it be that the way that you mediate between the two is that, like, the ability to use reason, and then taking the metaphor and extending it to a healthy or a not healthy person. So someone who screams to that extent is so disturbed by the infinite kind of nature of existence, is someone who hasn't been able to apply enough reason and rationality to how they should be engaging with that perhaps kind of unobtainable or inaccessible.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Michal. The reason is precisely the inner structure. That's the inwardness, that it fits into reason. And that which is beyond reason is like this surrounding radiance, which doesn't fit into reason. The problem is that in our lives we need a kind of a combination of both. And so if there isn't a dimension beyond reason, then there's another problem. You know, if everything in the person is rational, totally, you know, they can become like an automaton, and there's no love, there's no, you know, there's nothing beyond. So it's this very delicate process of balancing that which is beyond reason and that which is reason as well. The whole Chabad movement is called that because of its goal, Chokhmah Bina Da'at, wisdom, understanding and knowledge, to draw that which is irrational, beyond reason, into wisdom, understanding and knowledge. So that process of bringing that which is beyond reason into the realm of reason. And I would say that's, you know, that's in a sense the therapeutic process, like Malka said. And in one's own progress, step by step through life, you know, that's the chasm, the abyss which faces us sometimes, is where we don't see a way to draw this infinite dimension into the realm of reason, and then we're left with a response. Might not be as obvious as the scream on the bridge, you know, but it will be in other ways. So
but there will always be a response that is not in the realms of reason. If you're saying there is a balance, there will be a response that is not reasonable.
Oh, you mean because there is a beyond rational dimension which is still there if there's a balance.
And you cannot convert all the rational into rational.
Well,
like you can't.
Well, go on. Yeah.
Well, then that's where I was trying to go with the argument, because then someone who explains,
you need to balance.
Someone who explains their spirituality in a rational way can end up coming to the conclusion that the only reason for believing in a spiritual realm is because it brings some kind of value, it makes them a better person, and therefore the That's independent right. existence of that realm isn't necessary for you to have a belief in it and trying to make the effort to try and inform the way you think about the world. So saying I believe in God and I believe in the infinite, but only because I know that believing in it makes me live better, makes me do better things. So using rationality to explain the spiritual, which almost takes away the need for the spiritual to exist independently.
Mm-hmm. Therefore, it's not valid.
Well, I'm not so sure. You see, if the person becomes a better person, that might be a form of evidence, you know, like a symptom, as it were, an expression of the power of the spiritual. The problem is when they don't become a better person.
What is a better person?
All right.
Closes the system.
It closes the system. All right. But to move back a step, a mitzvah is beyond reason. And the mitzvah is not a scream which looks painful, but it's a melody which is beautiful. So you checking the mezuzah and Baruch Hashem, the kasher, you know, and then having the mezuzah and then having the mezuzah on the doors of your home, you know, like there is a non-rational dimension which becomes part of a person's life.
Yeah, but no reason will justify it, yes? There's no reasonable logic.
That, yeah, you're agreeing.
Yeah, but that's... You see, the mitzvah comes from the surrounding radiance. That's usually understood as the will. And the will, it's the divine will, which says this is the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to have a mezuzah. The mitzvah is to have a lulav and etrog. Yeah, so, or to sit in the sukkah for that matter. So, here we're looking into what's the symbolism, as it were. What is being represented by sitting in the sukkah, or shaking the lulav and etrog in the sukkah. And it's the idea of taking something which is beyond reason and transforming it into a level of personal rationality that somehow within one's mind these mezuzot suddenly become a real part of one's experience and one's life, and they become relevant on a tangible way. And there is then another dimension which is higher up, which is beyond reason. Because there's always a level beyond. There's no end to the radiance. So there's another dimension which is beyond. And so there is a sense in which we utilize aspects of the spiritual, which in themselves are beyond reason. We try, and the whole power of Jewish teaching is giving us opportunities to make those dimensions part of our personal human reality. That when one wants to eat some food, let's say, so there are several questions. You know, one question is this food healthy? Is it, you know, is it this? Is it that? Is it tasty? Is it Yom Kippur today? You know, so if it's Yom Kippur, then even if the food is healthy and tasty, well, there's still a question about whether or not the person's going to eat it because it doesn't fit into Yom Kippur. But and is it kasher? You know, so the spiritual dimensions begin to have a tangible physical reality as well.
Like a piece of music has got a CD that it comes on.
Well, you see, it's very interesting that you say a piece of music, because the laws of music can be closely compared to the laws of the Torah, in the sense that we are talking about a spiritual harmony. And why does this piece of music stop at this point and there is a rest of four beats and then it begins again? And that's an absolute crucial point within the melody. And if you were to play something in the middle of that silence, you would spoil the whole thing. That's like, you know, why on this day do we not eat and another day we do eat, and we dafka have apple and honey, and, you know, so the whole nature of life, where there is different dimensions of expression which are all expressing something which is infinite, which in itself is beyond expression.
Except that apple and honey, there is only one, and music, there is an infinite variation.
Well, what were you saying, Malcolm?
You wake up, oh, good morning.
Malcolm's always got to understand that.
It's not the same, because this is one particular case, and the music is a very...
Yeah, but if you take the case of the life, you know, the cycle of a day, you wake up in the morning, you say Moda Ani Lefanecha Melechai V'Kayam, you know, this is a little prayer to say right at the beginning of the day. Then you wash your hands, Negubas. And then you go step by step through the day with different brachot and then
different songs.
Different songs. Yes. Yeah, or different parts. Yeah. Different
each
bits.
Five, different songs.
Yeah, but they repeat themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Every day.
Well, the one with music you like, that you listen to it more than once?
Mm-hmm.
There is, but I know that there is an infinite amount of music around.
Is it the same? Because we did it yesterday, is it the same today? To me, I must say, each Yom Kippur is a completely different experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for many people. No, it's not.
There are things that get monotonous. Stuff, I mean, Yom Kippur is once a year, the stuff that's every day.
Mm.
No?
Well, it can. But I think, again, if one focuses on it in a different way, one sees the newness, the freshness.
Tall order.
This is very similar to music, as you can focus on the from the same piece, get more meaning or emotions. Yes, but I don't think that a pause is the same as the Abra and Hani. Yes, it's very difficult to say why is it that a pause of four beats, as you said, is good here or not. Yes. It's very difficult. I don't think that people can say this. But people can say that this music is good and this music is not good. And it, because of this surrounding thing.
It's not true. It's not about good or not. There are laws. Music is organized by laws.
It's not organized by laws.
It is.
Well.
That is the point.
There is a basic law, like a book is organized by letters, yes, but
it's just the same as the light you were describing about the different types of lights. The same, different. What you're saying and your wife's saying. She's saying it's laws, and you're saying it's something internal that you can't actually say it. And it's the same type of it's the different types of light we're talking about.
No,
she's both aspects in order to appreciate it or to be understand it. One doesn't live without the other.
She's talking about. Something that is more general, and I talk about something that is more liberal.
But you need both parts, you need all parts.
Oh, yes, in general, yes. Always.
All right.
I don't think we're going to make a lot of progress on the way back today.
Well, let's see. I think. You see, what we're really talking about is the essence of what this discourse is discussing. You know, this idea of peace. Now, there is another dimension of this, which it goes into in the next few lines, which is the idea of the korbanot on Sukkot, the offerings which are offered. And the point about the korbanot, let's just take this. V'gam yesh b'shivat yimei ha-sukkot. So here we are pretty well halfway, nearly halfway down this first paragraph. Gam yesh b'shivat yimei ha-sukkot. There's also during the 7 days of Sukkot, ha-inyan da-hakchavat shivim parim. The idea of offering 70 bulls. Now in the book of Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, we're still on the first page. It's half, not quite halfway done. There, in the book of Bamidbar, when it goes through the sacrifices on Sukkot, it turns out that there are 70 bulls which are offered. And the sages tell us those 70 bulls correspond to?
70 nations.
The 70 nations of the world.
You read it.
Shehem keneged shivim umot kedi'ita b'midrash. As it says in the Midrash, they correspond to the 70 nations. And he's saying that this also applies now, even though we don't have the actual korbanot, but we have the verses that we say in the psukim about the korbanot. And the point is that on the one hand, the 70 bulls protect the nations of the world. And on the other hand, the 70 bulls are somehow making the nations of the world appreciate the whole context of existence as understood by the Torah, that you have the temple in Jerusalem, the Jewish people, as it were, the priestly people, the Mamlechet Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh, who have the task to enable the whole world to relate to God. And so therefore, through this process of the 70 bulls, instead of the nations of the world attacking the Jewish people, they realize the truth of the Torah as it comes through the Jewish people, the concept of the seven Noahide laws, and there's a world of peace and harmony. So that means that this aspect, the korbanot, the offerings of Sukkot, represent a quality of peace. Now there's another dimension as well about Sukkot, which is, if you look at the last 2.5 lines on this page, V'hine ka'asher yom tov rishon shel chag chal liyot b'shabbat. Now when the first yom tov, the first day of yom tov, falls out on Shabbat, kikviyut shana zu, as it was this year, that's 1975, that then Sukkot fell on Shabbat the first day, the same way as it does for us this year. Yesh chiluk bein zman habayit lezman hagalut. There is a difference between the time of the temple and the time of exile. And he compares that to the blowing of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, the idea that where there was a difference, if you go over the page, Shebizman Abayit, the Yom Tov Rishon Shel Chag, in the time of the temple, on the first day of the festival, Lulav Doche Shabbat Af Begvulin, everyone would shake Lulav. In the time of the temple, in Jerusalem, in other places as well, Umeshechalav Beit HaMikdash, but when the temple was destroyed, Ein Lulav Doche Shabbat, one does not shake the lulav on Shabbat, even on the first day, which is Midoraita. There's an extra dimension to the first day, but one doesn't shake the lulav, kemavua b'mishnah u'gemara, as it explains in the Mishnah and the Talmud, as it says over there, at the beginning of the fourth chapter of Masechet Sukkah. Now, here he comes, so that's another dimension. So there's the idea of the four kinds of plants. So now comes the answer, which I've already been speaking about in Bet, chapter 2. Unukudat habiyu bezeh b'chol inyani meilu. The nukuda of the explanation of all these concepts is the sukkah hu inyana makif. Sukkah represents a surrounding radiance. And this is a radiance, loka makif de levush, not like the surrounding radiance of a garment. A garment also surrounds a person. But she'ime yoto bechinat makif, but the garment, even though it surrounds the person, mikol makom yesh bo itchalkut, but it divides up. Levush ha'arosh, the garment for the head, levush ha'aguf, garment for the body, levush ha'aregel, garment for the feet. Ma she'en kein ha'makif de sukkah, she'en bo itchalkut. The surrounding radiance of Sukkah is something with no distinctions. Shahari hu makif et rosho v'rubo. The whole concept of a Sukkah is you go into the Sukkah and the Sukkah surrounds you. I mean, this is the sense of radiance about the Sukkah, that the Sukkah is really a sacred place. And going into the Sukkah, one is walking into this kind of radiant quality, spiritual dimension. That's one of the reasons why in Lubavitch they do not sleep in a sukkah. Although the sages and the code of law and very widespread Jewish practice today, especially with modern technology, is to sleep in a sukkah. You can have a central heating in your sukkah. It's So one can have a beautiful, comfortable sukkah where one sleeps there as well. But the Lubavitch custom is not to sleep there. So there are several explanations given for this. And one is the idea that the unity of husband and wife is something very important. And women are not actually chayiv to dwell in a sukkah. They haven't got the duty to be in a sukkah. So usually who sleeps in the sukkah? The men, not the women. So that is regarded as a undesirable separation between a husband and wife, and they should be together. And so therefore a husband does not sleep in the sukkah, but he sleeps in the same room with his wife. But another dimension is that the sukkah expresses such intense spirituality, who could go to sleep in such a spiritual thing? Now you might say, do we recognize the spirituality? But if one is aware that someone recognizes that spirituality, then that also might mitigate against wanting.
But then how do you explain that our sages did say to sleep in the sukkah?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Maybe it gave you special dreams?
No, I mean, is their concept very different? Because, you know, how could they say that you could sleep in the Kodesh HaKadoshim? I mean, in something so...
That's a good
how
point.
How could they think it?
And if they said so it, was then it how can somebody from later generations come along and say, oh, no, it's too bad?
Oh, those Chabad can do everything. Upside down.
Well, that's part of the whole Kabbalistic dimension, that the Kabbalah comes along and steadily becomes more and more revealed. See, the project of revealing the Kabbalah, we could put the 13th century with Rav Moshe ben Nachman, Nachmanides, Ramban, who wrote a perush, wrote a commentary on the Torah, mm-hmm. which is obviously going to be a very popular commentary. And in this commentary, there are various comments which come straight out of the Kabbalistic tradition. And gradually...
You got it. Read it.
Yeah, and if you read the Haktamah, the introduction that he writes to his commentary, it's a very, very spiritual introduction. And then gradually more and more people, in the same century, the Zohar was revealed, and people began having manuscript copies of the Zohar, and it became more and more widely read. And so you have teachings which come from the Kabbalah, which in some way change the preferences, if you like, of what comes first, and you know what order to do things, how to do things, and sometimes things which seem very simple without a Kabbalistic perspective suddenly become more complicated and need to be approached in a different way. So there is the idea that some people are more aware, some people are less aware, and different customs in different places. But this becomes one of the elements in the idea that the sukkah is too holy, too spiritual, to sleep in. The other way that the Chabad, in its sort of more rigorous form, do not do what is called noi sukkah. Noi sukkah means all kinds of decorations in the sukkah. The way I was brought up, the Yekesh style, there were most beautiful little flasks of oil, yes, and I was quite fascinated by how they managed, like they had test tubes of flour. It was very interesting how they got all these things to be there. You know, not to mention bunches of grapes and apples, and you know, the technique of how you tie a thread round an apple so that it will hang up and not fall down on something. So all this kind of things. So then when I came to Chabad, suddenly no noise, or no decorate, no paper chains. And
no
paper chains. How do paper chains fit in with these spiritual... I mean, you can have paper chains, you know, but just...
we have paper
chains. Yeah, no problem. Enjoy.
I think it concentrates.
Okay. All right. You can, yeah.
Like if you look at an area on a roof, it's got many pieces of wire.
All right.
Okay. Not just one like that.
All right.
And apart from the answer to the question that was made there is that there is Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai says sleep. Beit Hillel says don't sleep.
If they did.
For example.
The difference is that they were at the same time. It's just...
Well, your question is about a concept called Yeridat HaDorot, the descent of the generations. Which would imply that the later generation has less spiritual power than the earlier generation. Right? So there's a famous academic discussion about the Hasidic movement, which seemed to reverse the process of Yeridat HaDorot, that you suddenly have people who have great spiritual insight, like prophets, you know, someone like the Baal Shem Tov, later figures. And so actually someone did write an article called The Concept, you know, The Reversal, I can't remember the exact title, but it was, the theme was the reversal of the theme of Yeridat HaDorot in the Hasidic movement. Now one of the explanations that the Hasidim have given to this, in order to maintain, you know, there's always this Jewish quest, as I put it, the English phrase, to have your cake and eat it. You know, in other words, to do two opposites at the same time. So you have your cake, you want to have a nice thing of cake, but you also want to eat the cake. So if you eat the cake, you won't have the cake. But somehow there's a way of doing both. So how do they maintain the principle of Yeridat HaDorot, of descent of the generations, and yet be able to claim a kind of a spiritual authority in some way more than people who lived 500 or 1,000 or even more sometimes years ago, is the idea of the dwarf on the shoulder of a giant. Yes, we are much smaller than the earlier generations. We are just like a dwarf. But we are on the shoulders of a giant. And so since we're on the shoulders of the giant, we can see further, and so we can therefore see this and this and this. So it is a claim of spiritual authority, and certainly there were people who resisted that claim, or resisted, and that's part of the interesting divisions within the Jewish world. And at the same time, it's a perspective which enables other divisions which are there to be healed. So it's half of one.
Double-edged sword. Yes, like that's
can
what.
Get on with
this? You don't want to hear me.
Alright. Okay. So there we have this idea of dwelling. Now, here we come to the focus. It's the word hare at the end of the line. He said that the sukkah represents a spiritual radiance. That's six lines down in Perek Bet. The word hare at the end of the line. Hare makif eino bevchinat hityashvut. If you're talking about surrounding radiance, how can it, that is the opposite of Hityashvut, of dwelling, of sitting, of being in a stable way inside something. V'imkein mahu inyan basukot teshvu. And if so, how can you talk about dwell, you should dwell in Sukkot? V'inyan zeh, now this idea of dwelling in the Sukkot, it says it again and again. And it actually uses, I'm just going to summarize the end of this paragraph, it uses an interesting phrase. You should dwell in Sukkot now, in order that your future generations will know that I made the Jewish people dwell in Sukkot. It's a rather strange formulation. So, if you look at the end of Mao, the last two lines of this paragraph, Mahu basukot teshvu, what does it mean? In you should dwell in Sukkot. Leman yedu dorotechem, in order that your generations will know, shahayediya shel dorot habayim, that the knowledge of the future generations, where does that knowledge come from? Al yedei tiyeh, al yedei basukot teshvu de dorot hakodmim, comes through the dwelling in the Sukkot of the earlier generation, of our generation. We dwell in Sukkot in order that the generations further ahead, they will know that God made the Jewish people dwell in Sukkot. What's happening here? It's a mysterious thing. Mm-hmm. And so, really the way that Michal talks about rationality and non-rationality, there are many, many beautiful images in this discourse, including the idea that the schach of the Sukkah represents the sounds of the shofar. The custom is to blow 100 sounds of the shofar. Tkiya, trua, shvarim, tkiya. And there are altogether 60 tkiyot and 20 shvarim and 20 trua. And that makes the word schach. Samach is 60, kaf is 20, and kaf is 20. So the reaching of the shofar into a spiritual realm beyond and drawing down a spiritual radiance, that's somehow expressed by the schach, the leafy covering of the sukkah. Then there's another image which it goes on to speak about. The katoret. We just had the Yom Kippur. And on Yom Kippur, the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies with a pan of coals, and he has a handful of incense, and he lets the incense burn on the coals, and there's this beautiful cloud of incense. Now, there's another idea that the sukkah represents the cloud of incense of the high priest on Yom Kippur in the Holy of Holies. So we are there inside this cloud of incense, inside this the sacred cloud. So then we come to the idea. This is in Perek Dalet. The concept of the sukkah of shalom, that somehow or other the makif, the surrounding quality, in fact does come that there is peace. Why? Because there is peace that the divine soul is able to dwell together with the animal soul. It's as if, there is the imagery, the sukkah represents Noah's Ark. Noah's Ark is a place, Tevat Noach, where different animals, wild animals, which in themselves would attack each other, dwelt peacefully. So the makifin, the surrounding radiance of the sukkah, is a place where different aspects of the person, which in themselves are at war with each other. Now, some people are very sensitive to the wars inside their own self, between different dimensions of their own personality. And entering into the sukkah, that somehow stills the anger and enables those different dimensions of oneself to be there together. And this peace is symbolic of the peace that will be in the future, asher lo yareu v'lo yashchitu b'chol ha-kodshi, that there will not be anything negative or savage in any way in my whole holy mountain, that the whole world will just be something which is positive and beautiful. And then comes, it's got very late, I'm sorry, the idea of Da'at. Now Da'at, there's wisdom, understanding and knowledge. Da'at, knowledge, is the ability to combine opposites in one's mind. That's the way it's understood here. Because if one only has a linear way of understanding things, then one is always being surrounded by situations which are not really comprehensible and make a person very angry and upset and are very difficult to cope with. But if one is able to consider opposites and be able to see the place for those opposites together, and even though this is black and that is white, and this is positive and that is negative. And nonetheless, they dwell together. Somehow, one is able to see in a multidimensional way. See, if our way of thinking is only one-dimensional, then two things going in a different direction, they collide together and there's a collision and they contradict each other. If you have two dimensions, then fine. So they can smoothly move without knocking into each other. Now, on a more complex level, so if it goes like this, it's still going to knock into each other. But if it's three dimensions, then it's you're giving room. So you can always have an extra dimension which enables a resolution of opposites, which is a way of saying what the Lubavitcher Rebbe once said, that every problem has a solution on a higher level of world. But at that higher level, you are going to hit another problem. And so then you have to go to a further higher level of world where that problem will be resolved. But then you will hit another problem. So the whole of existence entails hitnakshut, some kind of paradox, some kind of irrational structuring. And yet, if one is able to move to a higher level of consciousness, one is able to balance those different things. So the dart of being in the sukkah and drawing this surrounding radiance into a pnimiyut, that's really what the whole function of the Sukkot festival is about, using the lulav and etrog in order to draw that into an inwardness in such a way that one is resolving the paradoxes. One is not fazed by the paradoxes. One is able to hold the paradox. Just like, I would say, a therapist holds the paradox that the client has got and is able to provide that containing force or that containing framework which enables
my sister.
You're
good. Yeah,
I know. Now she's going to tell me.
Mine's off. It's alright. We're coming to an end anyway. So the quality of that, of knowledge, is able to contain these different contrary aspects, and that is the peace which the sukkah brings. Now, the fact that at the beginning, this would seem to be an impossible process. However, who began the process? God. God made the Jewish people dwell in Sukkot when he took them out of Egypt. That scene here, it's a kind of an intellectual history instead of only a political history. That scene, or a psychological history, the first step in making this surrounding radiance, the beyond rational, dwell within a rational framework, was God, by taking the Jewish people out of Egypt and making them dwell in Sukkot, which meant that the spiritual radiance is able to dwell inside them. Then we are able to mirror that. And therefore we are able to dwell in the Sukkah and absorb these irrational dimensions and make them, which are super-rational. They are spirituality beyond rationality, and we're able to take that into our own lives and somehow make it part of us through the quality of Da'at, which is really a kind of personal illumination. Da'at is the point where reason and that which is beyond reason somehow come together in a way of inspiration. See, inspiration is a very interesting concept, because the inspired person has both rational concepts, and also there are elements which are beyond rationality. But it's benichuta, it's in a positive way. It's not like someone who...
Odlo. I need kasher or not.
It's not like someone who is left behind completely the realm of rationality. So And that then becomes the key for the Ezrach b'Yisrael. That is the shining of the future, like the citizen who dwells in the Sukkah. But that Ezrach is like Zarach means shining, and Aleph at the beginning is one of the letters which makes the future. Otiyot Tanya, Meshamshot La'atid. The letters Taf Nun Yud Aleph, they make the future tense in Hebrew. And so Ezrach is this, the I will shine, but it's the whole idea of shining in the future. So therefore, through the fact that we now sit in the Sukkah, we are generating the energy, Leman Yedu Dorotechem, in order that your generations will know in the future, which means all the ramifications of life. They will all absorb this quality of that which is beyond reason, dwelling, behit yashvut, in a settled way, with that which is within reason, in a way of harmony and peace and goodness, which through the imagery of the 70 bulls also includes the nations of the world. So it's a global project, and Bezrat Hashem, we should be able to fulfill our part of it. This will come.
Very nice.